Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition. Maybe there is hope. This episode is sponsored by Smart Othello. So Daniel, when we've talked recently, you've been on vacation. And where are you now? You still on vacation?
Of course I'm on vacation.
All Manton, right.
This is my new lifestyle.
Indie lifestyle. Permanent vacation.
You've heard of the term, the often derogatory term, lifestyle business.
I have.
So I'm just going to take it to the max. I'm just going to always be on vacation from now on. Somebody tweeted at me when I said something about being on vacation. They were like, weren't you just on vacation? And I was like, yeah.
Believe it. Yeah. I agree with you. Like, lifestyle business started as... well, not a compliment, I guess. But I think a lot of people have taken that on and say, no, that's okay. It's okay to have a business that supports my family, supports going on vacation when I need to, being independent.
Right.
Working a lot, but working for yourself. So it's a little different.
Yeah. And, every once in a great while, you get to like lord it over somebody that you did have two long vacations in a summer. And then, of course, you know, when I'm like working to keep my server up on like a family holiday.
Right. Answering support email on the beach instead of running around. Right. Yeah. You know, a lot of companies now, startups, have kind of embraced the idea of we're not going to track vacation time anymore. And I've read about a few, and it's kind of interesting because on the one hand, I when I worked at a regular job, I hated all paperwork, but especially any kind of tracking vacation hours and clocking in and out and anything like that. I hated. And it's a stupid thing to complain about, of course, but it's just, you know, I feel like as long as you're getting your work done, like, why do you need to have exactly 8 hours in a day? Or why do you have to exactly track how many hours of vacation you're using? So a lot of companies are coming around to that. But interestingly, I've read some things about how some companies that have unlimited vacation time actually need to go back to having a set amount of vacation time just so people actually use it, because they'll feel guilty if they take like a month off. They'll never do that. They'll feel guilty and they'll actually take less vacation time than they're supposed to.
Yeah, I remember reading about this, and on the face of it, it sounds like such a great like liberal policy. It's like this is perfect. It's kind of like the unlimited maternity leave or something, where it's like, you know, take as long as you need. And putting the question of how much vacation an individual quote unquote needs in their own, you know, in their own charge, that's kind of like a mind F.
It's too much power.
Keeping it clean. Yeah. and it really sets up the possibility for a very uncomfortable dynamic between employees, because like, I remember, you know, when I worked at Apple, I think the magic number was 240 hours of vacation, I guess, was the number at which if you had 240 hours a vacation accumulated, then it wouldn't accumulate anymore.
Right.
So it was like, I don't know, what is that, like 6 weeks or something? I don't know. Somebody who knows math can, I guess
I'm
that would be
saying 30 days on my,
6 weeks.
So that's a while, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but I, you know, the way it worked out, at least among my peers at Apple, was there was a kind of a weird, sick pride about being at 240, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not one of those softies who needs vacations, and that's not healthy.
No, it's not.
That's not good. But I think, in fact, saying that there was unlimited vacation maybe is even worse, because then you have to always, there's no distinction between like, well, like at least when there's a fixed amount of vacation, you can be like, well, I just got to use this vacation because otherwise I'm going to go over 240, and then I'm, you know, going to be wasting my vacation. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, if it's always on you, whether it's the right time or whether your vacation is justified, then that means like every vacation could be, even if it's not appropriate, could be scrutinized by your peers or your boss or whatever. So that doesn't sound super comfortable to me. Mm-hmm. that's kind of like all you can eat at the right. at the restaurant. It's like, well, maybe it would be better if you just put a fixed portion on my plate.
Right. Let me go back once, not three or four times. Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a reasonable middle ground where you say, yes, you know, everyone gets like about whatever, 3 or 4 weeks of vacation or however much. And we're not going to track it like exactly. We don't care if you track it by the hour, but like everyone's expected to take about this much vacation. And if the boss takes vacation and you see people around you taking vacation, you know, there's no guilt or any kind of bad feelings about it.
Now the other extreme, I think, which is also interesting and probably the one that's really worth companies pursuing, is the idea of mandatory vacation.
Right.
Right. Like,
yeah.
Like at Apple, you got to 240 and you just started, you were effectively wasting your money because mm-hmm. The vacation is literally worth cash. Like if you were to quit or be fired or laid off or whatever, and you had 240, this is another reason I think actually people kind of liked having that bank of vacation, because then if they did ever anticipate leaving the company, they'd leave with like 30 days extra pay.
Yeah, that's true.
But like if, you know, if for example, you get to 240 and they say, that's it, that triggers an automatic, you have to take a week off.
Yeah.
Like at that moment.
Right at that moment. Drop what you're doing, pack your bags.
Well, yeah, this is just one approach, I guess, that yeah. companies could take. But if they took that approach, there would be a strong incentive to keep your vacation, to plan your vacation.
Yeah.
And to, and even if you're not the kind of person who maybe wants to take a bunch of long vacations, maybe you say, well, I'm at 200 hours, so to keep this in check, I'm going to take, you know, every Friday off for the summer.
Right.
The whole idea of mandatory, I think, is good because it just builds in the idea that you're going to have to spend these days one way or the other. You choose. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you choose or you organize it with your peers and manager, but make it work, people.
I think it's good. I mean, even if it's not exactly mandatory, it should be strongly encouraged. And you should be reminded, hey, you know, you haven't taken a vacation in a while. Like, you should take some time off. And you should, yeah, plan right. for it, so I don't say, hey, don't come in tomorrow. And then you don't know what to do. You don't have anything planned. I mean, it's another difference between, like, a regular job and being independent also is that, I mean, when we talk about vacation, it's very difficult to completely unplug when you're running your own company and you have no help. Because there are some things that you just can't put off. I mean, if you're working at a company, even if it's a small company of a few people, and you take a week off and someone sends a support email in, I mean, there's no reason that you need to answer that. Like, someone else can take care of it.
Right.
But if you take a week off and you get a support email and you have like the principle that you're not going to let someone wait a week on getting an answer on support, it doesn't matter that you're on vacation. You're going to take 5 minutes. You're going to answer the email. And I personally think that's fine. Like, I think it's okay to be on vacation and work 5 minutes a day or whatever it takes. But
Manton Reese's new, you know, pop. Yeah.
It's like the 4-hour work week.
Advice book. Right. 5 minutes a day.
5 minutes a day is all it takes. You can get a lot done in 5 minutes a day. I don't get a lot of support email. I just answered one before we started recording for a customer yeah. who lost their serial number or didn't get one, didn't receive it for some reason. You know, it took 15 seconds. I mean, I'm not saying you can actually work for a long period of time, only 5 minutes a day. But when you're on vacation, you can get a lot done in a real small amount of time. But again, and we've talked about this before, it's okay to spend a few minutes to avoid having that customer wait a week and also to avoid the guilt that you're putting something off for a week.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the you pick your values. If you're going to go indie and start your own business, whatever it is, whether it's software or something else, you pick your values and you apply them to the business and you hope it works. But like, yeah, for you and I are on the same page that we believe strongly in support and responsiveness. Many people who are successful don't share exactly that attitude. And I guess, you know, you just got to apply your values to your own business. It's kind of like, you know, those like restaurants that are like famously popular because of or in spite of their like terrible service, right? it's like the soup Nazi thing, right? It's like, you decide, I guess, what the temperament of your business is going to be. And yeah, if you decide, like Manton and I did, that customers kind of get 7 day a week, 365 day a year access to you, then them's the breaks.
Yeah, you just can hope to grow a little more, to have some help, or to be able to outsource. A lot of people outsource things like support and kind of the day-to-day stuff. And I guess if you do that, then, you know, it frees you up to not worry about that stuff when you take a week off.
It comes down to values again. It doesn't, that the idea of outsourcing it outright scares the heck out of me, mm-hmm. because, you know, abusing the like restaurant metaphor again, that to me would be like having all of the food shipped in like, you know, airline packaged food containers, and then you just dump it onto the plate. Maybe that's a little bit extreme, but I feel like
saying if the chef takes off a week, they revert to like McDonald's takeout or something and give people.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, who cares? Yeah. That's the same thing, right? It's they wanted a burger, they put the burger on the plate. Being willing to sort of suspend your own interaction with a crucial part of your business doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, I guess taking this restaurant thing too far, the comparison would really be the head chef takes off, but he's got whatever, the sous chef, the assistants, whatever, I don't know restaurant terminology. And they've been working with him day to day. And so they have no problem taking over and being in charge while he's on vacation.
That's ideal.
And so the same thing would be like, if you had somebody that you could occasionally lean on to take over support, and they saw, you know, you CC'd them on responses, so they saw how you handled it. And then even if it's just for a few weeks, they kind of see how that's working. And then you go on vacation and they know, okay, I understand the style and I understand what's expected and I can fill in.
Yep.
But you can't just expect to just hire someone and leave and not have, and it's not really training, it's watching how you do things so they can try to mimic it as close as possible.
Right. Well, and I guess getting back to the idea of choosing your values, it's about them picking up on what your values are.
Right. Yeah.
And I really reacted, though. I mean, the reason I jumped right into the, like, you know, putting airline food on the plate is the term outsource to me. It sort of implies like a don't ask, don't tell, mm-hmm. like just make it happen. Like
it implies like we're saving money, you know, kind of. We're not doing things like,
right.
Yeah.
And it implies like, to me, it implies like a, we totally don't have to deal with this anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's the opposite of what your metaphor of like hiring the sous chef and training them up. It's like, yeah, if I could, I would love to have, I mean, ideally, I think I'd have another engineer, software engineer working with me, who also pitched in on support. Mm-hmm. And then I would feel completely, well, for example, Manton, you and I, can lean on each other. If our only business were core intuition, then I think either one of us would feel perfectly happy leaving for 2 weeks and the other one just handles all the core intuition.
Yeah.
You know, communications.
Right.
And that's not nothing. There is a support angle to it. It's not really customer support, but it's maintaining the public communication channels of the business.
It is kind of customer support, really. I mean, when we get an email from a potential sponsor or a listener, I basically treat it exactly as I would like a question about my software. I mean, more or less, right? It's like I mean, that you want to respond to them if you can. You want to help them, want to answer the questions.
Yeah. And that's all we know. So we apply the same same tactics.
Yeah, that's true. And also, I like your kind of the way you mentioned if I had someone that was also an engineer. And I think the nice thing about that, I mean, there's obviously people that are great support that are not engineers. And any company of a certain size is going to have support people that don't know how to program. That's fine. But the nice thing about having someone has a similar skill set to you is they'll probably know without a lot of help what they don't know enough to answer, if that makes sense. So Mm-hmm. You know, that if you're on vacation and they get an answer and they don't understand that technical part of the application, they're not going to just make something up, probably. They'll probably right. know enough to say, okay, I don't know exactly what's causing that. Here's a couple tips, and Daniel will get back to you next week. And that, I still think that's good customer support. You know, and you get a response, maybe you get some help, but you also, you're not just waiting a week. You know, you're getting the heads up as a customer that the person really in charge, that really knows every line of code in this, is going to solve your problem. Just hold tight.
You know, the relationship that comes to mind that's kind of probably perfect for this discussion is Peter Lewis from Australia. You know, mm-hmm. Interarchy, you know, way back to what, Anarchy, what was it?
Oh, yeah.
Before. And the way that he, I think my vision, at least for the history of his software work, was in particular with Interarchy, was that it was his thing. He was the only engineer. He did everything. And then he sort of like brought on Matthew Drayton to help him, I think, at first. And then fast forward to today, Interarchy is Matthew Drayton's app. Yeah. So this kind of relationship can exist. And I think probably for many years there, it was like they could lean on each other too. You know,
right.
this kind of gets at a bigger subject, which I think we've debated before, which is whether it's preferable to be completely indie and be on your own, or whether it's preferable to have a partner.
Right.
And we could go on and we could probably just make this show about that and talk about that every week. But but obviously you and I have ended up doing both, because we're doing, you know, each of us is like 100% indie on our personal projects, our, you know, personal companies. And then I don't think either one of us would keep going with Core Intuition if it was a solo thing. So right. It's kind of a funny contradiction.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, some types of projects just require more than one person. And a podcast with two hosts is one of those. Yeah.
Well, but for example, you know, you have your own other podcast projects. Mm-hmm,
true.
And I've done my own, like, bit splitting. The formats for those is appropriate. It's fine. People want to listen to them. But for some reason, we don't. I know you're still doing your podcast, but it's not the same amount or regularity as this. So
yeah, no, and that's something I've been thinking about a lot, too, because one of my other ones, the one I do by myself, timetable, I haven't done in a month because things just with summer and family, and just I just don't feel like I've really even had 10 minutes like in a quiet room that I can focus. And so I went from recording a couple of them a week to none in a while. And I'm going to get back into that soon, but it is different.
Yeah.
It is a lot different than this show. I think also being independent, I love, you know, and I work with other people on client projects. And of course I work with you on the show. I do love doing everything for my own business and my own projects. But I also have some things that I want to build that I want to last a long time. And at some point, I'm not there right now, but at some point, I want things to be bigger than just me. Because, I mean, one person doesn't, you know, I can't build something right. that will outlast me, for example. It's impossible. So there's things I'd like to do that I'd like to be bigger and, like, you know, longer kind of big picture stuff that just makes sense to have more people. Even if that's just one person to pass it on to, like you were talking about with Peter Lewis,
yep.
or if it's a smaller group or even a bigger group. I mean, there's stuff that I'd like to do that is bigger than one person, but for now, the type of stuff I'm doing, I love just doing it myself. And there's a lot of advantages to that.
I think we're on exactly the same page there. And it's kind of funny that we end up on many of these subjects agreeing, basically. But these are things that not everybody agrees on. There are some people who are like 100% they would never do something on their own. They want somebody else mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
And there's also many people who are committed to never hiring anybody, mm-hmm. never never having it be any bigger than themselves, because they found that comfort zone where it's like, this is what I want.
Yeah.
To be like this forever. I'll do all the support. I'll do all the work, all the engineering, all the marketing, all the, you know, filing the taxes, whatever. And hey, you know, there's an infinite possibilities. I guess we're just here to explore them.
Yeah. And we're lucky that we are in a business that is so flexible. You know, it's like I was just reading yesterday, WordPress has 500 people. And, you know, WordPress.com, like automatic, the business side of WordPress, mm-hmm. 500 people. Yeah. That's a huge company. I consider that a really big company making blogging software. Hey, look, I'm making blogging software. You're making blogging software. I mean, we're just one person. And so I love the range there that one person can build blogging software and 500 people can. And there's no right or wrong. I mean, it's just, it's different scale and different approach, but they're both equally valid.
See, if you want to have a one person company that barely gets by, charge money for your product. If you want to have 500 people who are filthy, stinking rich, just charge nothing.
It makes no sense. Yeah. Yeah, they're charging something.
I know. I remember that those VIP hosting plans are pretty attractive.
Yes, yes. And they just rolled out .blog, which I'd like to revisit when they actually launch it, but there, I think there's some big money in that. In fact, I mean, I looked at one of the .blogs I wanted to get, and they wanted $2,000 just to register it. So there's money. They know what they're doing over there, I think.
Yep.
Well, we are once again sponsored by SmartGo, this time not for Go, but for the just-released Othello app. Anders, the developer behind SmartGo, also happens to be the 1992 U.S. Othello champion, and he thinks you deserve an Othello app that doesn't suck. With Smart Othello, you get a well-designed app to play against the computer or against your friends on Game Center. Othello, also known as Reversi, has simple rules, but strategy is more complex. Smart Othello protects you from playing blunders and teaches you how to improve your game. Smart Othello is just $2.99 for iPhone and iPad. No in-app purchases, no gimmicks. Go to smartothello.com to learn more.
Manton, the first thing I noticed when I opened Smart Othello is how nicely designed it is. And it's great that that's, you know, something he wanted us to point out in the pitch is that, you know, finally something that's well designed. And I, you know, unlike Go obviously is a hugely popular worldwide game in some circles. I had never really played it before. And Othello, on the other hand, I feel like it has had more of a sort of popular culture impact, at least in, I recall playing it as a kid. So this is kind of fun for me to go back in and play around with a game whose rules I sort of understand more implicitly. And boy, it's just like really easy to play. And how cool is it that you have a former U.S. Othello champion who also makes iOS software?
That's awesome.
And you know, you can't ask for more authority on this game. I mean, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I doubt that there is another iOS developer who has also been a U.S. Othello champion. Right. That would be funny.
That would be great.
But yeah, one of the other things you mentioned is it teaches you how to improve your game. And one of the cool things I noticed right away, well, it didn't take me long to experience that feature, because one of the things that happened right away was I'm, you know, tapping around playing the game, and then it puts up this alert. It's like, it almost looks like, oh, you know, this, you're about to delete your files or something. It says, are you sure? Like, there's a red caution, and it's because I'm about to play like a total doofus move. And so it's like, instead of just like making you figure out through trial and error over, you know, repeated games that, like, I guess the strategy isn't working, it'll say, are you sure? And you can just go ahead and play the play if you want to. Or you can ask it to explain. And it says, like, gives you a little diagram and gives you, it's like a categorization of like the kind of error you're making. I'm looking at one right now. It says, I made a mobility error. It says, your move flips many frontier discs and thereby blocks your access from that area of the board. So it's trying to help me out. And then also while you're playing, this is, of course, in the play against the computer mode, it lets you like undo your game infinitely so you can go back and try other strategies. And it's just really nicely designed. But then, you know, after you're done practicing your skills against the computer, you can invite your friends and play against friends who are either, you know, old time former U.S. Othello champions or total novice noobs like me and Manton. But very, very nice game. Of course, we are just delighted to have another indie developer sponsoring the show. Andrus does great work, and he has these, just these great stories, like the former championship. So thanks so much to Smart Othello for sponsoring the show this week. And once again, you can pick it up for just $2.99, iPhone and iPad. There's no in-app purchases. You just pay and enjoy. And you can learn more at smartothello.com.
All right, Daniel. So you had a tweet last night, and you know me, I'm not really on Twitter exactly, but sometimes people point to tweets, or I randomly find them, and I saw this one.
You were reading Twitter habitually, Manton. Just admit it.
I won't admit it. No. It's now that I have my CrossPost account, Manton, too. One of the things I do on it is I don't follow anyone, which means I have no timeline to read. Which is a very interesting experiment. Like, if anyone's curious to see Twitter in a different way, try it without reading a timeline. Because what you do is, it's almost like reading blogs without RSS. Well, what do you do? You just kind of like randomly click on a few people that you know, and then maybe you follow a couple conversations and tweets and, you know, kind of, you know, spend a few minutes just kind of going down the rabbit hole and figuring out what people are talking about. But it's a very different experience than reading a timeline that's refreshed all the time. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I found this tweet. And you say, software is the easiest money in the world when it's easy and the hardest money in the world when it's hard. Trite and true. So where does this come from? Like, what are you thinking about that made you post this?
Well, this is, as is so easy to do on Twitter, it's really easy to assume that everybody is looking at the world through the same lens. And I often view my Twitter comments as kind of like commentary on what everybody's thinking about right now, because obviously everybody's thinking about the exact same thing I'm thinking about, which in this case is the sort of like general discussion that was revived by retrospectives by John Gruber, Brent Simmons, Dave Wiskus about their app Vesper, and sort of a little bit of a post-mortem about, you know, so catching people up, they are effectively, you know, canceling that product. And they've had sort of retrospective about why it didn't succeed as much as they hoped it would. And I've noticed that this is like a litmus test for people's attitudes about viability of software. This keeps coming up, and in particular with respect to iOS, because I think it really is legitimately harder to nail a successful business model that's not totally schemey on iOS. And so whenever something comes up where it's like a retrospective, it's like we talked about this a few years ago, or a couple years ago, I think, with Jared Sinclair and Unread. The question comes up again and again, like, is it fundamentally just like not possible to make a living with software, right? Because this is something that I think a lot of pessimists, at least on Twitter, absolutely believe, and they seem to reiterate it, especially when things like this Vesper issue comes up. I get certainly a lot of pushback from people when I put opinions out there and about making a living with software, and people will say things like, you know, paid software is dead, everything is subscriptions now. And I'm like, oh, excuse, what? I didn't get that memo. You know, I'm still getting, I may not be making the money that I wish I was, but I'm still getting regular, you know, bank deposits from Apple and PayPal, and I'm still selling people's software licenses, and all those people don't seem to have gotten the memo either that this business, the whole business that I've invested the last 20 years of my life into, is dead. So when things come up like this, Vesper retrospective, I noticed the same thing happening. It's like, well, even if you make a perfectly well-designed product, you know, the amount of engineering that goes into it is just too great, and, you know, nobody will pay for software, da-da-da-da-da. And that's one experience. That's one unfortunate, in this case, experience, because it's our friends who made this software and weren't as successful as they wished, or that, frankly, we wished. But it just got me thinking. It's like, so getting back to that tweet, I wanted to draw attention to the idea that it can be both. It can be both really, really hard to make a living at this. And then sometimes it can be like, how is this even working? Why? You know, like I've talked a few times over the years about this weird like success that Mars Edit has in Japan, which is weird because it's not localized in Japanese. It's like something's wrong with the system where like, you know, Apple just keeps like selling the app to Japanese users and they keep paying me. And it's like, that's an example of, you know, because to be honest, sales are not great for me. This is not the best time in history for Mars Edit. And occasionally I'll have like one of these like $300 days, which is, you know, these days pretty good for me. And I'll look at it and I'll be like, oh, it sold like 5 copies in Japan.
And just imagine if it was localized.
I know. But that's an example where it's easy because I'm not directly involved in that. That's just happening. It's beyond my control. And that's just one example of many. Like, you know, a few years ago, you know, it just happened that things were doing much better than they are now. But I don't think that was because software as a concept was more viable then. I think I was riding a lucky wave. And I'm ready to ride the next lucky wave.
Yeah.
I'm not just gonna, right now it's like this little microwave of like, oh, that's cool. For some reason, people in Japan who can suffer through an English language app are buying the app. I don't know what the next crest is gonna be or what the next valley is going to be, but I sure as heck don't agree that it's like all valleys.
Right.
And so when I say it's the easiest money in the world, when it's easy, it's because like it's sort of, you know, as we know, one of the thrills of making software and selling it is you do the work, you put it out there, you try to market it, you try to get the word out. But I think it's rarely directly correlated to what you've done, or at least when you've done it, that you see the big success come in. And when that big success comes in, it sure feels like easy money because it's like, whoa, I just did something in my home office that's like at the peak of my sales success. I think I was making twice as much as I made in a quote-unquote real job. Mm-hmm. And that just sustains me for the times when I'm making half as much, right? But
yeah, you have to get used to like the ups and downs of it. But you do also, you have to set yourself up for that easy money, that success. You know, it's not random that
you're selling
more in Japan, or that you had a great sales day when you launched the last version or whatever. You know, you did a lot of work that allowed that to happen.
It's not random, but it is unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the frustration, and that's what I'm trying to capture here, I think, is that's so frustrating when you can't seem to latch on to the wave, so to speak. You know, you can't seem to lock into the cycle of what's going on to get that success. It's so frustrating. But then when you get caught off guard by the success, it's just like, I remember thinking like, well, this is the way my life's going to go from now on. I'm just making twice as much as I made in a regular job. No wonder I'm an indie. Pat myself on the back and then but I just want to encourage people not to take a side on this, not to just be like, you know, because I'm mostly picking on the people who are negative here and saying it's impossible to make a living, but I'm also picking on the people who are like, it's easy, just make a game that is like Flappy Bird and you'll be rich. You know, that's not true either. It's like, there is, it's very hard to predict how to do this.
Absolutely. And it's even hard sometimes to know when you've had the success, why it happened. Sometimes it's obvious, but a lot of times not, you know, and like your question of like, why are my sales better in one country than another? You're like, not exactly sure. It's difficult to know sometimes. And it's certainly difficult to look back and like see the failures and try to figure out, well, what could I have done that would have turned that failure into something that was successful? But I think there's also kind of a middle ground where you see an opening sometimes. You're like, if I just did something, like, and sometimes you don't know, and except in hindsight, but I do think there are opportunities where you see something shift like an opening in the market or a sales bump or some reviews, or you see something and if only you could kind of like invest in that and double down on that. So, you know, you maybe it would take off. And I feel like I'm kind of okay at seeing that, but very bad at actually following through and doing what I need to do. And that's kind of vague, but like a good example, like I joked about the localization, but what you're saying right now to me, like that seems like a really obvious thing that you should do for the next version of Mars Edit. Yeah. Like you should absolutely have English and Japanese, not 10 languages. Like I'm actually way against like localization before you need to, because localization introduces a lot of headaches in the development process. It ties your hands for adding features and changing the UI unless you have a team of, you know, localizers or, you know, outsourced translators. And even that, it adds a lot of extra just work and back and forth. Like I hate to localize an app before it's ready. And I've worked on apps that are in 10 languages or more, and I find it a complete pain to do. It adds a lot of work. But
yep,
if the market is telling you, if only you did one localization, you would increase sales by 25% or something like that in that country.
Right.
Then that's something you should do.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's 20. It could be that this weird, like, outsized popularity in Japan could mean that I'll make like four times.
Well, yeah. Because I mean, I've in my head, going back to early days at Apple, I've always thought, and I don't know why, just following Apple and reading things, I always thought Japan in particular loved having a native version. You know, and there are a lot of people in various countries, but in Japan in particular, I've always had in the back of my head that like they will not use your app if it's English only.
Yep.
So I said 25% is just like, I'd be shocked if it's right. less than that. It could be double.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's true anymore, but I think in the old days it was certainly true. And Apple in the old days, again, like they had major investment in Japan, and it was a really great market for Macs and Mac software.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a sense, I think, though, that like there's more we could do sometimes that we don't do. And getting back to Vesper, I mean, one of the things Brent mentioned was now we know we should have done a Mac version, is basically what he said. It's been years, we didn't do the Mac version. Knowing what I know now, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but like if we had started with a Mac version or followed up with a Mac version very quickly, it would have been more successful. And, you know, he says something like that, kind of knowing in his heart it's true, but of course he doesn't know for sure. But it's like a sense you have of like, okay, looking back on this software product, like what could we have done differently that would have improved things where we'd be able to keep investing in development resources and design and doing the Mac version is one thing that kind of sticks out for that product for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I alluded to that sort of it being impossible to predict and how to, you know, impossible to know how to find this quote unquote luck, how to catch the wave. And that was sort of an interesting, there was sort of an interesting Twitter interchange about this, I think, that came out of my tweet, and it ended up with somebody recommending a discipline, I don't know, a sort of methodology for business analysis called job to be done. Does that ring a bell to you?
So, no, I haven't heard that.
So I guess it's been around for a while, and I'm going to definitely look into it because it sounds like the idea is really finding business opportunities by like looking back and like analyzing what literally drove people to pay money for stuff. like you know, if you're thinking about like, what do I need to do to get people to pay money for me, for my stuff, it's not the worst idea to look back at other successes and say, okay, like literally why do people buy a car, right? Like, and I guess you can kind of like get a like you can be like me and throw your arms up and say, I just don't know, I just don't understand why people in Japan buy a Mars Edit, or you could like try to use some methodology to figure it out and thereby hopefully inform your future plans. So this is going to be on my homework list, and maybe some of our listeners will check it out too, but there's a specific episode of Horace Dedia's podcast. It's old now. It's you know, the Critical Path podcast, and it's there's a specific episode where he talks about it, and I'm going to go back and listen to that because I I sort of implicitly trust him to give a good introduction to it. So we'll link to that in the show notes. But maybe there is hope, Manton. Maybe we don't have to just accept that it's the easiest money in the world when it is and the hardest money when it isn't. And I certainly am willing to believe that it's possible to do more planning than I do, because I don't do very much planning.
Yeah, I don't know. I've struggled with this too. My own software products are not doing as well as they could. And of course, my time is really split between, you know, consulting work and different projects, yeah, and, you know, whatever. And the summer, just not really getting as much done as I'd like to. But I also, kind of wrapping this back to how you started this discussion, not just with the tweet, but the idea that, you know, you look out there and, like, there's all these successful independent developers. So this is not like an impossible challenge. It's very difficult, but it's not impossible. One of the things that makes it more difficult to judge, though, is that you don't really know who is, like, truly successful by the definition, right, of they're making a good salary on their, you know, iPhone apps, for example, alone and nothing else, and who is successful but not at the level that you think they are. Right. And I'm not trying to, like, I mean, look at myself would be a great example. Like, if all I blogged about, which I have in the past, like my independent apps, you might think that, like, my independent apps are, you know, pulling in six figures and, like, everything's okay. But, like, that's not the case. I'm doing a lot of consulting. I'm doing the podcast. I'm doing other things. So I have successes, but, like, if you just look at one of my, like, my Mac app or something, there's no way that app supports anything. Right. And right. So I that makes it difficult to judge the market and kind of judge, I don't know, just levels of success, mm-hmm, and, like, what types of apps can actually support a person versus what types of apps are just, like, one in several apps that you would need, mm-hmm, if that makes sense. So it's just difficult. And the more open people are, I think, too, that kind of helps.
Yeah. I think I need to go back to sort of like baseline defiance that got me everything I have and everything I probably will get. And that is based in, when possible, don't define what you can achieve based on what other people have failed to achieve, mm-hmm, right? It's like, don't look at it and say, well, and I'm not trying to, like, pin this on Vesper or anybody in particular. Just say, like, if you use, like, somebody out there not achieving the success that you wish you had as evidence that it's not possible, then you're just going to fail at everything, because right, there's always an example of somebody who failed to achieve something. And I think at my worst, I fall for that negative thinking, and I think, oh, maybe I do need to find a new, you know, business. Maybe I need to get a regular full-time job. Maybe I need to, I don't know, switch to making Flappy Bird games. But at my best, I look at those complaints and I think, well, that would, you know, making a living on software is impossible for them, but not for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to prove them wrong.
Yeah. I like that, though. I mean, it's a challenge. Right? Oh, we know this is difficult. Yeah. I mean, no one now today getting into this thinks it's easy. Now, when the iPhone App Store launched, there were a lot of people that got in thinking that there was a gold rush and that it was easy. And for a very brief time, I think it was kind of easier. But, like, that's years past now. No one thinks this is easy. But that doesn't mean it's impossible.
It's not easy. No. That's right. So I think that's the battle cry, so to speak. Let's just go out there and prove them wrong. And I think a lot of us will, if we, you know, you can't just go out there and say, well, I'm going to prove them wrong by just doing the same thing I've been doing that's failing again and again. But, you know, go out there with a willingness to figure out, to unlock the secrets of, you know, the fact is there is a market, and there are people who want or need things. And we are there to try to get ourselves into that circuit. I actually had another tweet, Manton, just to toot my own horn again. I was kind of like, you know, riffing on this last night, and I liked this other one, which is also sort of trite, but I think captures my thinking pretty well, which I think I just said there's four categories of software. There's software that people think they want, software that people want, software that people think they need, and software that people need.
Okay.
And you can kind of pick which type of software you want to make. So, for example, like a software that, you know, keeps you on your schedule for your diabetes insulin or something. That's something kind of like people need, right? Mm-hmm. Software like Flappy Bird is maybe something that people want. And then there's like software where people buy it sort of aspirationally because they think that they want that, you know.
Hmm. This is interesting. I don't know,
this stuff's kind of sounding vague, but this came to mind because I think it's sort of an advantage we have making software that it's kind of like an art, but it's an art that also has utility, right? So like, it's frustrating to try to like make a novel and sell it, or it's frustrating to make a painting and sell it. It's frustrating to record an album and to try to sell it. But very rarely is any of those also going to like remind somebody to take their insulin. So, and this probably comes back to like doing some more analysis, doing some more research, but we have, I guess this just sort of supports my defiance of the idea that it's impossible, because there are software categories there that people either really think they need or really do need. And I think that's the angle, that's like the half of the spectrum that I want to go for, the sort of like popular culture software, the games and, you know, like novelty gag stuff, not disparaging that, but that's just harder for me to tackle. So like the software that people want or think they want, that's like the, like, you need to have like the pop sensation for that to work. Mm.
This is really good.
And the software.
Go ahead. I like this a lot. This is.
Oh, we could go on for this forever too, but I just wanted to mention it because it ties in, I think, to this whole idea that this whole question of whether it's hopeless on the software market. And as long as you can think of something that people need, well, that's a big leg up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like this a lot, the way you're describing this and the wants and needs of what they think they need or want versus what they actually need or want. I'm going to think about this and kind of put my own products in this little group. And I think you can look at, I mean, when you talk about the market, you know, we talk kind of about the iPhone software market as a whole, but every app has a different kind of market. And what people need can change based on your competition too. And I think Vesper saw that for sure. Like the market kind of changed out from under them, right? It's like with Apple's Notes app becoming a lot better, other competition becoming a lot better. You know, the market can change. And that, I think that changes the need part more than maybe the want. But like, if you make something that people need, and then all of a sudden, two other people make something that people need, you know, the same people, then you're having an issue. But I agree with you overall. Like, having software that people actually need or think they need, especially for productivity software, for software that we're trying to actually sell for money, I think that really that really helps thinking about it in those terms.
Funny example comes to mind in the think you need category. How many people have you run across who think they need to have Adobe Acrobat installed on a Mac? Right? Because it's like, you know, you get to a page that says like, you know, warning, before you download this PDF file, you really need to have Adobe Acrobat installed. And I've run into this a lot with people who are like, oh, I need to go get Adobe Acrobat. And
really? Lately? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just a funny example where it's like, that's a good example of something where people think they need something, and that's going to motivate them to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I like your idea too, though, of like taking this as a, because I think the reason I call it trite, but I think it is kind of a, I think it kind of does cover it in its sort of like looseness, it covers all the software. And I think you know, that kind of like game where you make the quadrant and you plot the mm-hmm. things, you know, how much is this like close to the is this a thing you need or an actual need, or is it somewhere in between? And I think you can kind of put software, classify it into this quadrant, maybe with this way of looking yeah. at it. And that might be kind of fun to think
that's
about.
That's kind of, when I read this, first I was confused and then I read it again. That's yeah. kind of what I had in my head though, visualizing it as kind of like a quadrant. This probably could be, well, it's a podcast, so maybe that's enough. But I was going to say it could probably be a blog post with a little graphic.
Yeah.
But I like it. I like this way of thinking about things. And you know, anything that we can use to kind of look at our software business and see what's failing and what's successful and what maybe, again, needs to be, what opening that we have that we didn't really know we had that we could invest more in and be successful. I think that really helps. So
yeah,
thanks everyone for listening this week. It was good talking to you, Daniel, and we will talk again next week. You'll still be on vacation, I'm sure, because you're perpetual vacation.
Somewhere, someplace.
We don't know where. I don't even know where you are now. I don't think we talked about it. But thanks everyone for listening again. And don't forget the jobs board. It's at jobs.corint.org. If you have any feedback, we're on Twitter at Corint. We're on email at feedback@corint.org. And we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you then, man.